This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. When's the last time you were driven to distraction by new love? Or so angry you couldn't see straight, let alone think straight? We tend to think of emotions as diametrically opposed to rational thought and intellectual activity, thinking with your heart, not your head. But in reality, emotions are a product of our brains, just as our intellect is. Later this hour, we'll explore some of the biology of love and attraction, a little nod to a certain holiday coming up later this week. But first, let's take a closer look at the idea that emotions interfere with our ability to think. It may be conventional wisdom, but Dr. Ominda O'Hare says it may be an outdated notion. O'Hare is assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. She heads up the Cognitive and Affective Psychophysiology and Experimental Science Lab there, and she joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Ominda O'Hare, welcome to Living Lab.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We typically think of emotion as clouding our thought process. Is there a scientific basis for that?
Well, there is definitely a lot of evidence that supports that emotion can be very distracting. It can move our attention away from things that we're trying to focus on. It can cause us to pay attention to things that might not be as vital to a decision, and then bias our decision more towards an emotional choice than what we would call maybe a rational choice. But as you mentioned, the flip side is also true, that there are a lot of instances where emotion can really help us focus our attention, can help us make quick decisions that are more optimal when we're in these situations where you just need to react, and overthinking can actually kind of get you into trouble.
So give us an example of that. When could emotion actually be helpful in making the right decision?
Well, there's, of course, the instances where you're actually being threatened. And in that case, really just reacting and doing whatever you can to get out of those situations is what you want to do. And emotion can really fuel that system and help you do that. But also in less threatening situations, for instance, when you're given a decision that has multiple things you need to consider, sometimes if we try to go through that decision as rationally as possible, we get a little overwhelmed by all the information that's available. So if you actually go with kind of your gut, we tend to actually make really good decisions if we just do that. It's called heuristic decision making.
Could this be true of any emotion, or are there certain emotions that are perhaps more inherently distracting and others that are more helpful?
Depends on the situation. But yes, in general, when I mentioned the heuristic decision making, that tends to be positive emotions that help us do that, as well as actually being angry. Where sadness or anxiety actually tend to make us overthink the problems and get so distracted by all the information and overwhelmed that people tend to really never make a decision. They just avoid trying to answer it.
So we sometimes talk about, you know, say something like, if you're angry, channel that anger to do something with it. That to me seems like a very conscious choice to kind of try to take the energy perhaps that comes from the anger and use that energy as motivation. Is that what we're talking about in terms of this interaction between emotion and thought processes, or are we talking about something more fundamental, perhaps a tighter biological connection?
Yeah, I would call it more of a fundamental connection. I think a lot of people have heard of the fight or flight response, that most emotions can provoke this kind of a physiological reaction from us, where our attention narrows, our heart rate quickens, our muscles become more efficient. So that's where I see that emotion can sometimes actually improve cognitive performance, when you really just need to have this focused scope of attention, ignore distracting information, and just stay really goal-oriented. Then sometimes you can actually see a boost from having some negative emotion in the environment.
So how did this idea that perhaps the conventional wisdom that emotion kind of conflicts with intellectual or rational thought, how did that idea come about and get to the point where you're actually now studying it scientifically?
So, I mean, it's a very old idea. Actually, both of them are old ideas, that emotion can be distracting and emotion can be facilitating. There's an old law called the Yerkes-Dodson law, that there's basically an optimal amount of physiological arousal that you want to be under to perform pretty much any task. And so if you are kind of a calm, laid-back person, you actually kind of need a little bit of an emotional kickstart to reach that optimal level. But if you're already kind of a high anxiety person, maybe a little tense, the extra emotion can make you too high on the arousal scale and crater your performance. So that's a really old law. I think it's back from like 1949. But then as far as psychology research has gone, of course, whenever an area of research starts in psychology, the focus is usually first on psychological disorders. And then we kind of figure those out and we start looking at more basic science, normal populations. And when you look at individuals with the anxiety and the mood disorders, the fact that emotion is distracting and impairing their cognitive processing is pretty apparent. So that's why that is such a strong idea in society, that emotion is distracting, because we have these extreme examples of people who have basically stopped being able to function because of all the emotional stress that they're under.
Are there examples on the far end of the spectrum where we end up with mental disorders because there's too little emotional arousal, or too little emotion involved?
Yeah, there are disorders that are associated with that. We'd call that flat affect, when you just don't seem to have any sort of emotional response. And that's really interesting, because not only do they not have like the fear responses and the distracting responses, but they also tend to not experience the rewarding and positive emotions as well. Those are pretty rare. You see those in like sociopaths and other related disorders.
Okay, so when you actually want to study the relationship between emotion and cognitive function, how do you do that in the lab? What does one of your experiments look like?
So what I do, is I use tasks of cognitive control, or sometimes people will call them tasks of executive functioning. And what these tasks do are, they're very basic stimuli where there's some aspect you need to focus on and other things you need to ignore. So the Stroop task is a really well-known task in psychology that does this. In the classic Stroop task, you show people colored words, like the word blue, yellow, red, and they are presented in different ink colors. So if you show them the word blue and it's in blue ink, you're going to ask them to respond to the color of the ink and ignore the actual meaning of the word. So if both those things match, that's a pretty easy task to do. But if you show them the word blue and it's printed in green ink, they need to respond green and ignore the word saying blue at them. So that's a task of cognitive control, because they need to ignore the distracting word meaning and stay focused on ink color. So all I do is a modification on that task, making it an emotional Stroop task. So instead of the word blue, I'll use the word terror or hatred or bomb in different colors and compare that to their responses to table, cabinet, bland. And we look at response times, accuracy, and then I use a technique called electroencephalography, or people know it as EEG. And this technique is able to record the electrical output of the brain. So I put 64 sensors on a person's scalp.
That's a lot of sensors on one head.
It is. I have a little small army of students that work in my lab just for that purpose. That I train them on how to get those things on and off as quickly as possible so we can do research in a reasonable manner. But actually, that's even not the most high-density systems. The ones I used in grad school had 128 channels, and some people use 256.
What do you get by having more and more of these electrodes on a person's head?
So some newer analysis techniques have made the higher-density systems more desirable. One thing you can do is a principal component analysis, which basically, with systems with less channels, you'll see these really big electrical components. And for a long time, we just thought they were single components, like the P300 is a really well-known one. It's a component that reflects your selective attention and your ability to kind of monitor and update your situation. So if I show you something new and surprising, you're going to get a really large P300 response. But now that we've added more channels, we can analyze that more carefully, and we've realized that it's actually a couple components that occur so close in time, it looks like one big one, unless you have enough channels to pull it apart.
So basically, the different electrodes are kind of monitoring different parts of your brain, different functions that your brain are doing, and clearly you can get more detail if you've got more electrodes there.
Right. And the other reason you'd want a lot of electrodes is because we've also now developed ways to do source localization with EEG, which is some complex algorithms that, thank God, I didn't have to figure out. But they let you estimate where in the brain exactly the signals you're getting are coming from. And people have been able to confirm those with the other tools like fMRI that actually do brain imaging. And now we know that the source localization techniques are actually really accurate. So That's another reason you'd want all those channels, because it lets you do that more accurately as well.
So why is EEG a great tool for studying emotion versus cognition, as opposed to, say, one of these, you know, the brain imaging techniques, I think, are so hot. They're kind of sexy, right? I mean, people can go and look online and see these images of different parts of the brain lighting up. You don't get those same images from EEG, but is there something that makes it a particularly useful tool?
There is. With the brain imaging techniques, they are great for looking at exactly where in the brain stuff is happening. But they rely on blood flow, and it takes about 8 seconds for blood to flow to a part of the brain that's active and then to go back down to baseline. And there's a lot that happens in your brain in 8 seconds. Now, that's another area where we've really improved in the methodology in neuroscience, and they're getting that, so it's faster and faster. But it doesn't come close to comparing to what we can do with EEG, where we get changes in the brain's electrical fields in the order of a couple milliseconds.
And of course, that electricity essentially is really how the brain is functioning. The blood flow is kind of a secondary response, but the electrical activity is actually the brain activity.
Yes, that's correct. So especially when you're looking at emotion-cognition interactions, they're very nuanced and they happen very quickly. So we start to see differences when people see emotional stimuli versus a non-emotional stimuli within 10 milliseconds of us showing them that stimulus. So you really have to be able to catch brain data as fast as it starts happening to start to see these effects.
So why use a word as the stimulus? I mean, because people might, you know, have a different idea of what the definition of a word is, perhaps, or a different association with it. Could you do something like show them an angry face and ask them what color shirt they were wearing or something like that? Would that give you the same sort of experiment, essentially?
Yeah, and I do use a series of different stimuli. So the words are good because I don't want to evoke too much stress in my participants in some of my tasks. In other ones, I do. So there's actually a great lab down in Florida that has developed all these stimulus sets. And so there's a word set, there's an image set. So in one of my studies, I use these emotional pictures, and the negative ones can get really upsetting. So if anybody's ever been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, I won't run them in this study, because it's like pictures of people who have been injured that are pretty graphic, some pictures that are pretty violent, like gunshot wounds and that kind of stuff. And then the positive ones are like kittens. there's some like romantic pictures and the whole spectrum in between. So there's that set. I also have a stimulus set of emotional digital sounds that I haven't run a full study with yet. I keep piloting with them because they have kind of some interesting effects. They seem to work a little bit differently than the other ones. But those ones can also be really provocative. The negative ones are like people screaming, sounds of police sirens, where the positive ones kind of sound like amusement parks or children laughing. And then you mentioned faces. We also have face sets where we have all the different emotional expressions that we can use with the faces. So,
what about smells or tastes? Would that?
Some people do that in this area of research. I have never dabbled in those kinds of stimuli.
So you don't just do this once. I mean, the same person might have a varying response. So talk about how many times a person might have to go through a trial like this, and how much variability you do see from person to person, and even with just one person from trial to trial.
With the EEG, an analysis technique we do is creating event-related potentials, which is basically taking the data from every time we show someone, say, a negative word, and we average that together, because the electrical activity we get from the brain is tiny. We have to amplify it 200 times just so we can see it on the computer screen. So we really have to run a lot of trials to get enough responses averaged together that they actually are analyzable. So in my studies, you're going to have anywhere between 140 to sometimes 400 presentations of these stimuli.
How long does that take? How long is a person sitting there in your lab with all those electrodes on their head?
My shortest study right now, that's about 12 minutes. So that's
not
too bad.
Wow, that's really fast.
Yeah.
I mean, these are flashing up, a new word flashing up every few seconds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just takes a couple of seconds. I mean, that's what's nice about doing the electrical activity is you don't have to wait for a return to baseline. You can do just a couple seconds in between your trials and then try again. And then sometimes they're in there for up to 30 minutes. I try not to push it past that because we know the bounds of our sustained attention. And I know, especially using undergraduates that are coming in to do in the lab, that they get really bored after seeing those words over and over again.
So how do you select the people who will participate in your studies?
So most psychology departments at universities maintain a subject pool where students in intro to psychology classes participate in research as part of their course credit. They can opt out and do research papers if they want, but the majority of them opt to actually go to people's labs and participate in research. So that's what I primarily use. I'm also doing some collaborations where I'm going into the classroom and doing some work with people, like whole classes at the same time. But mostly it's the students that I use.
Now, we tend to think of emotion as being a human trait, what, you know, our own emotion. But when you're studying emotion, you actually separate emotion into kind of three categories. And there's the person's emotional response, but there's the emotion of the situation. So what do you mean by that? How do you quantify emotion, I guess?
Right. That's a good question. It's something that people in my field will discuss ad nauseum. That's a constant part of debate. So I try to look at emotion in a sophisticated way. So there's of course the emotional content of my stimuli. And that's all quantified, that we have numbers for how negative versus positive every stimulus is, how arousing it is, meaning how much does it evoke a physiological response from you. So there's that level of emotion. But then I also look at individual differences in trait emotion. So all of my studies, we use surveys of trait anxiety, trait negative mood, emotion regulation style. So we're trying to get an idea of how does this person in general deal with emotion. And then you also have to consider the emotional content of the situation you're putting them in. So sometimes rather than having an emotional stimulus every trial, we'll just have them watch something emotional before doing a bunch of just basic cognitive trials to see if we can change the overall mood that they're currently in addition to their usual trait emotion. So everything I do, we're looking at three-way interactions, which makes it complicated. But when you look at all the emotion research, if you're not looking at all these different things, your results are really going to vary study to study because people are really different in how they handle emotion.
I'm talking with Dr. Aminda O'Hare of UMass Dartmouth about her research on emotion and cognition. More after a short break.